I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Every morning, we awake to a world marvelously alive. Where do we encounter awe and wonder in this world? In animals and plants, in deserts on mountains, in forests, ocean, and sky, in history, art, and science, in human striving and human kindness. Join us as we quest for the awe and wonder of knowing we are part of something infinitely larger than ourselves. Come stroll with me through nature, through a preconception of nature, that is. I'm sure you'll recognize a little stereotyping here. For most of us, the word nature elicits pleasant images, often in shades of verdant green, alluring scenes of plant and animal life, birds taking wing over field and stream, butterflies and bees alighting on the stamens of flowers to gather nectar and imbibe the morning dew. Oh, and the ocean! It's a rare soul who doesn't covet a chance to bask along a sandy beach barefoot or climb a coastal summit to catch the last golden rays of the sun as it dips behind the horizon and twilight draws near. But, to be fully honest, nature also signifies an endless number of places you would never feel reverie or find a placid path for strolling. Landscapes where ooing and aahing might well give way for shrieking and wailing. A violent volcano spewing lava, ash, and gas. The pitch-black cold waters of an oceanic trench. A hazardous crevasse that extends down to a glacier's icy base where unimaginable pressure steadily scours the bedrock away. These inhospitable places might not be suited for your survival, but today on Constant Wonder, we're going to consider organisms that from one day to the next not only survive, but apparently thrive, minding their own business, all fat and sassy, in regions that we have often thought of as lifeless zones. Recent scientific explorations have identified tiny living creatures, unlikely as this might seem, even deep in the Earth's crust. Among them, organisms that can breathe mineral material, withstand hyperacidity, and stay alive for hundreds, thousands, perhaps even millions of years. These creatures have been dubbed extremophiles. Their discovery upends many preconceptions we have long harbored about what can and does live on Earth and where. And to make this topic all the more fascinating, wherever life is to be found on or in the Earth, it shares common critical DNA. Every living thing is connected to every other living thing genetically, wherever, whatever. Karen Lloyd, a microbial biogeochemist, that's a title we'll come back to, recently returned from a trip to New Zealand where she was hunting some of these microscopic extremophiles deep inside some hot springs there.
I got to sort of go hiking through the jungle, guided by some folks who are the guardians of some of these hot springs that we're sampling, and got to chit-chatting. And I said, I can scientifically prove that all of life is related to each other. I know that scientifically. And she looked at me and she's like, yeah, I know. We know that. Our religion tells us that. I was like, that's fantastic. Cool. Independent confirmation.
So when you say all of life is related, you're looking at that through the lens of what? DNA? The big grand tree and all the branches of life forms on Earth?
Yeah, you can look at it through DNA. I mean, this is a shocking fact. We can know in our hearts things are all connected. We can look and see similarities between us and certain animals and say, well, we're definitely related. But we can actually take the DNA from every living thing on this planet, and I mean every living cell on this planet, and we can line them all up and see that they all came from the same parent. Which is crazy. 3.8 billion years is a lot of time to have evolution. So we've really gotten away from each other genetically. But there are a couple of genes, we call it 16S ribosomal RNA gene. We can take just that little strip, not the whole genome, but just that tiny little piece of DNA out of my DNA, my children's DNA, lichen DNA, sponge DNA, pine tree DNA, bacteria DNA, little streamers in Yellowstone, we can take that same piece of DNA out of everything. And it is not identical. If it was identical, we'd all be the same thing, but it's close enough that it couldn't have happened randomly. This is something that we all got from our common ancestors.
How remarkable is that?
I think it's remarkable. I mean, it blows my mind. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, but why?
Because I guess, I mean, it's sort of the reason, same reason that we look for extraterrestrials, right? We don't want to be alone. And so this is a nice way to draw us all together and remind us that we are all kin to each other, everything.
A scientist like Karen Lloyd has devoted years to finding and describing living material that is tucked far away and hard to reach, such as organisms inside the Earth's crust. To be technical, she is, as I mentioned earlier, a microbial biogeochemist. Revealing this hidden world of living things, things that are minute but every bit as alive as we are, and as we heard her say, even related to us. Well, that's the primary aim of her book. It's titled Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. And if maybe you just misheard the title as extraterrestrial instead of intraterrestrial, the correct title, well, that connection is intentional. Intraterrestrials that Karen and her peers in science have located and described, well, they may strike us as being just as outlandish as if we were to stumble into Steven Spielberg's E.T. hanging out in the kitchen. Just as crazy as spying one of George Lucas's Ewoks in a tree out in the backyard. But unlike those mythical creatures from Hollywood or outer space, intraterrestrials are homegrown. Long before Karen Lloyd became an academic and a scientist, she was already an explorer, very much committed to locating weird things living on Earth.
There's all these opportunities to make wishes when you're a kid. You know, your birthday candles or like throwing a coin in a well or an eyelash or, you know, the numbers on the clock all being the same. And I just decided that I was going to point all those wishes towards finding a unicorn. Because I figured a unicorn is a plausible, magical, this is when I was a kid. Sorry, I'm a scientist now. I'm no better now. But it's a plausible, magical creature because it's just a horse with a horn on its head. Like evolution is like totally cool with that. It could happen. And so I thought there's probably a unicorn somewhere and I want to be the one to discover it. But even if it's not me who discovers it, I want it to be discovered. And so I would make that wish at every single opportunity just to like focus all my wishes at that. And so it kind of feels like I'm still doing that, but in reality land. And I mean, I think that like wanting to find magical things is pretty standard for kids. And it's probably pretty healthy, you know, to seek out wonder and things that are not what you would expect. And the unicorn thing, you know, if you're going to go for a Pegasus, that's, I mean, how do the aerodynamics work? The mechanics, the lift, they are not aerodynamic ungulates, no. But a unicorn seemed real plausible. And still magical.
All grown up, as she now is, Karen has put her unicorn search on hold. But the living curiosities that she's actually discovering and carefully documenting are stunning threads in the big tapestry of all the life Earth has to offer. And as she's already said, these things are all interconnected, interrelated.
So intraterrestrials is not actually in common usage, and I'm putting it out there. I didn't invent it. Some of my colleagues did, but the parallels with extraterrestrials are intentional. The idea is that there is life inside Earth that is so different from life as we know it that it kind of seems like alien life. It's not actually alien life. Like I said, we know that it's related to us, but we just learned about it in the past 10, 20 years, and we continue discovering more of it.
When you say these life forms are embedded inside of the Earth, how deep into the crust are we really talking about here?
as far as finding life goes, what we interact with on a daily basis, maybe we dig for worms in soil, or maybe we, you know, our feet get buried in the surf when we're at the beach. Maybe that's as deep down as we go, or maybe we dig a hole in the ground to bury some cable or, you know, a septic tank or something. But you can go even deeper than that. You can go down in a deep gold mine down to 8 kilometers is the maximum depth that people have found life.
Well, I'm perfectly happy to go with Karen's suggested use of the term intraterrestrial. That works for me. Life forms that live inside Earth, beneath our feet, whether we find them in the first few inches or first few miles. And just like creatures that live on or above Earth's crust, sometimes these latter ones are called superterraneans, ants, elephants, fish and fowl, everything from penguins to puffins to people. Well, intraterrestrials also exhibit a wide array of distinguishing features or behaviors. One category of intraterrestrials that Karen studies is a group that even before this episode, you're quite likely to have heard about, and we've mentioned them, extremophiles.
A phile means like, and extreme means extraordinary. And so it would be things that like extreme conditions. So for instance, the volcano that I descended into, the crater that I descended into was Poás volcano in Costa Rica. It's a very, very active volcano. And when I went in 2017, it was a very calm day. So we weren't super worried, but still even going in, it's not an easy hike. You kind of have to be an extremophile yourself a little bit to get down there. It's not nice rocks. They're glass. And so they're very sharp and they're very scrabbly and it's easy to fall. And once you get into the bottom of the crater, there's a lake that when I dropped my pH meter into it, it read 0.85. Which is less than a pH of 1, which is the most acidic thing I've ever measured in my life. And so it is basically, and it's sulfuric acid, so it's battery acid. And the ground is 100 degrees Celsius, so it's boiling ground. So you have to keep your boots moving so they don't melt, and you have to not fall in the lake. And so it's all very scary to be in there, plus the whole thing might erupt. And, you know, hearing all this, you may say, well, why would life even bother with this? This seems very inhospitable, but it's actually teeming with life. And there's lots of microbes that live in this exploding every now and then lake that's less than pH 1. And the reason is that they are really good at getting all the energy that comes up from these deep volcanic gases. They're not waiting for plants to make their food for them. They're making their own food from what comes up from the volcanic gases. And it's worth it to them.
So there you are, Karen, about to go inside a volcano, down to a lake so acidic you wouldn't survive a swim, maybe not even a bad splash from the stuff. And you're hoping to find things that are alive? I mean, how can these microbes live out their lives in stuff that we can't even touch? I'm just going to take an educated guess and say that they're specially adapted in some way.
It's actually kind of a neat trick. So all of life that we know about actually wants the outsides to be more acidic than inside because we want these little things called protons to rush back in and we can make energy from it. And so it's almost like they get this energy for free. The problem is there's too much of it. So it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose and that's dangerous. So what they do is that they toughen up their cell walls and they maybe create some more positive charges on the inside so that there's not so much of a gradient. And then at the end of the day, and they all have to do this, they just bail. So they're constantly like just pushing all of these acid protons out of the cell constantly. So it takes a lot of effort, but seems like it's worth it for them. They like living there.
Everything you just said sounds like a scientist talking science, but I know you have a hat of just being a person in a scary place too.
Yeah.
You were a novice. This was your first descent
Yes.
into any volcanic crater.
Yes.
What is that like in terms of just your gut reaction to the place?
I was talking to my colleague, Katie Pratt, the night before, and we were taking it very seriously and making sure not to take any more of our team than we strictly needed to take down. And I was talking to a volcanologist and asking him for tips and stuff. And then it became clear in our conversation that he wasn't going to come with us. And I was like, but you're a volcanologist. Why aren't you coming with us? And he's like, oh, I don't really need to go. So I try to minimize my contact with volcanoes if I don't really need to go. I was like, oh my God. And so I write about this in the book. For some unfathomable reason, Katie and I started sipping Gatorade. I don't know. Like, it's like all we could think of to do, like maybe proper hydration would prevent a volcanic eruption or something. I don't know.
Do you remember approaching the brink of that acidic lake? Because step by step, I understand you're watching your footing. Do you want to have a syringe or something to pull the water out? What's going through your mind?
Well, I kind of smelled it before I saw it. If you're ever around like really strong acid, it sort of hits you in the face and it sort of singes your nose. So that it wasn't like overwhelming, but it was like in wafts as the wind blew around. And so it's like, whoa, you can really smell that. And you know, it's an acidic lake because you can smell it in your nostrils. But I couldn't see it coming up to it because there's sort of a hill of ejecta, which, you know, just in your mind, like knowing that this is ejecta is like, okay, if that thing goes off right now, I will be part of that ejecta. but I climbed up over this sort of berm of ejecta, and then I saw the lake before me, and it was just stunning. I mean, it's just so great. Like, it's I never quite know what to do with myself when I'm faced with natural beauty like this. You know, I'm like, should I dance? Like, what is the proper reaction that would be commensurate with the beauty that's in front of me? And I don't know, I always feel like I picked the wrong thing, but I wanted to at least write a book about it and try to share it with people.
Now, this dancing business that you're talking about is very important to me because I have danced on a mountaintop, seeing a lot of pines on cliff faces and the eagle soaring by and maybe ferns and some moss and a little pika in the rocks. I could dance. And you say something so interesting about the idea that this was as beautiful to you as that greenery or a little trickling stream somewhere with some happy little fishes and a unicorn maybe.
Yeah. I mean, this is part of what I love about being a scientist, is that it's so firmly grounded in reality. We do interpret it, but it's like just truth, like trying to look at the truth. And so I at least have this conception of a babbling brook of nature. Like, imagine yourself in nature. Like, if I'm doing like a guided meditation and somebody says, imagine yourself in nature, like I will see a lot of green, I'll see leafy things, and I'm conditioned to believe that. But nature doesn't know that that's what it's supposed to be. Sometimes nature looks like a gravel-strewn parking lot with broken beer bottles all over it. I mean, the glass was not actually from broken beer bottles, but it's the same kind of feel, like industrial kind of. The water is bright green, like green-blue. It's like a marble almost, like 1990s neon yellow/green. You know, like the stuff that you'd see on like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And here it was, and it was natural, but it didn't feel natural. And even though that's not in my human story that I've created about nature and all its greenery, it is nature. And so I'm tasked with, it's my job to change my conception of what is natural to be this, because that's truth.
I've interviewed people who've been up in space, and they talk about the little fleeting moment they have to look out the window and see the Earth, and they have that feeling of just wonder and awe. But then they have to get back to their work. Were you in that same predicament of needing to do your work and having no real time to just kind of take it all in?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's almost always where I am at these places, especially a place that's so dangerous. If we had just been there to be tourists, we would not have gone down. So we had work to do. We had to get straight to work.
Let's get into that work and some of the science, because you were gathering samples and it's acidic. You get it in the syringe. You just gather your samples and then hightail it out of there?
Well, we needed to filter them. So when we're trying to gather the microbes that are living in these lakes, we need to run them through filters to catch them, basically. And so we had to just pump a bunch of syringes full of water through these filters. We have a pump now, but that's when we were starting out, and we didn't have a fancy pump with us. But we can filter faster now.
So to recap, Karen and her team had to be vigilant about their footing with every step down into the crater, both because their boots could melt if they held still for too long, and because the ground is made of glassy shards. after siphoning liquid from an incredibly acidic, electric blue-green lake. They had to filter out the existing organisms there so that they could then take home these microbes without taking home the battery acid soup that they live in. All this sampling during her visit in 2017 was completed without incident. But just 54 days after she left, the Poás volcano erupted, completely vaporizing the lake.
It was kind of terrifying. It was the biggest eruption they'd had in 60 years. And it definitely would have killed us if we had been there that day. But I don't want to oversell the danger of us going in, because when it erupted, it had been acting very angry for weeks. So there was plenty of warning. And so my colleagues had been watching it, and they've got webcams set up and they have gas monitoring systems. And they knew that they needed to not be in the volcano that day. And so it really does give us a little bit of warning sometimes.
I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm imagining you on the day of that eruption and learning about it. You say that that had a really big impact on you. Not just to, in the way of wow, but I mean, almost philosophically, you had to rethink what that place was.
It definitely made me want to trust the people that I work with when I go places that I'm not familiar with and defer to them and never push it beyond what's safe, for instance. I feel very strongly about that. But yeah, I don't do this stuff lightly, and I don't do it as a thrill seeker. I do it because I want to know about nature in all its capacities.
This field work that Karen does is a crucial part of her professional expertise. Retrieving microbes for study from those extreme environments, well, that's never going to be risk-free. Working at those hot springs in New Zealand, that was no child's play, though probably not quite as unnerving as descending to an acidic lake in the hot crater in Costa Rica. And then, as you'll hear later, she has also tucked herself into one of those deep-sea submersibles to make a free-fall descent to the ocean floor. She's not touring such places. She goes where she goes to gain access to the microbes. Apparently, you go where they are because they won't come to you. Now, if they happen to live in remote, extreme places, the question remains, extreme for whom? Always sizing things up from the human perspective, though that might not always be the best way to pick your home if, for instance, you aren't human. Not even if you're distantly related to one. I think it's crucial to bear in mind here that the very term extremophile is problematic if the extremophile in question does not experience its habitat as the least bit extreme. Here are some perfectly normal microbes living in perfectly normal conditions that we humans quickly brand as extreme. Thermophiles, they live in very high temperatures. Acidophiles, in very acidic conditions. We've already acquainted ourselves with these first two categories. Then there are alkaliphiles. These are culturally on the other side of the fence from acidophiles. Halophiles need salinity. Radiophiles are adapted to high levels of radiation. Psychrophiles, well, they want it very, very, very cold. And piezophiles, sometimes also called barophiles. These hang out deep under lakes and oceans, and living for them is literally a high-pressure job. So a precarious life is all relative. As a human, I suppose I could make a go of things in the Antarctic, maybe in the Sahara, but I'm no little mermaid named Ariel crooning to be part of some other world. Karen Lloyd is a microbial biogeochemist and author of Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to the Constant Wonder Podcast. Dramatic tensions in life can be overwhelming. Working through them can be well worth it if we see that our efforts are genuinely helping to secure justice, to lift people up who are downtrodden. BYU Radio has a new original podcast that gets right to the heart of life's classic conflicts and tensions. It's called Conflict Coach with Dr. Emily Taylor. On this podcast, Taylor, who is a certified mediator with a PhD in psychology, helps real people grapple with real conflicts, from disputations at home to tensions in the workplace or community. Conflicts are part of life, but they don't have to ruin it. Each episode reveals strategies for developing better relationships, even when there's disagreement. Learn how to find what's actually at the bottom of a specific kind of interpersonal tension. The podcast's great value comes when you get to witness actual situations with participants being coached through real difficulty by Dr. Taylor. Look for Conflict Coach with Dr. Emily Taylor on BYU Radio or wherever you get your podcasts. Back now, though, to that term intraterrestrial. Just how intra can a terrestrial get? We're going to drill much further down now in this episode, further from the Earth's surface down to deeply hidden realms, where little, if anything, is familiar to us. Karen writes, "We have not yet encountered a depth at which life ceases to exist." And apart from considering spaces where these microbes exist, we also need to think about the time frames in which they function. With intraterrestrials, not even the passage of time itself seems familiar to us. Just imagine, if you even can, how it is that little things can be situated down deep. Think of fossils surrounded by sedimentary rock, or insects trapped in amber. Places where things don't move. Time takes on a decidedly different pace there. Here's Karen Lloyd trying to imagine with us the situation of these living single-celled microbes down in the deepest habitable layers of planet Earth.
What would your day-to-day life be like? Well, you're not going to have the sun coming up every morning and going down. I mean, that's all happening way outside of your reach. You're not going to have seasons, and really not much is going to change at all. Your chemical environment, your physical environment is really not going to change. So these organisms, when they get buried or when they find themselves, however they get there, in these deep, dark recesses where nothing changes, they don't seem to do much. They seem to just sit still. We could use the word dormant, but dormant implies that nothing is happening. Things are happening. They're eating. They're breathing. We can see them do this. We can see them take up food. We can see them produce food, but they don't ever divide. And that's weird, because if you think about like E. coli or the stuff that makes you sick, germs and pathogens, that stuff divides really fast, but they are not doing that. They are just sitting still and kind of being zen-like for, we don't know. We can hypothesize that they can do it for thousands of years. You know, there's trees that live, bristlecone pines and sequoias, that can live for 1,000 years or even multiple thousands of years, but their individual cells don't last that long. The cells turn over faster than that. But these are cells that, as far as we can tell, live for that long. One of the coolest things I think that the intraterrestrials are showing us is that, you know, we take in food, we put out wastes, we always have to be processing. If we're not, then we're dead. That is a universal thing of life, universal nature of life on Earth. These intraterrestrials have to be doing that too. The thing that sort of takes the lid off of our assumptions about that need is that the intraterrestrials sort of make us pause and say, over what time scale does that have to occur? I could live without eating for an entire day. I don't want to, but I wouldn't die. But I cannot live if I don't eat for a year. That's too long. But what about these ones? These are simpler beings and they don't need as much stuff. And so they stretch food out over much longer than we do.
How much longer?
Well, it's all guesses. I mean, it's guesses based on data, but it's possible that a single cell could live for 100,000 years or 1 million years. It's possible.
What you're saying is so extraordinarily subversive to my way of thinking about what life is and what life does, that if I really take that to heart and think of a single cell, I'm just going to say 1,320 years, a very short time.
Yeah.
A very short time. Mm-hmm. I can't wrap my experience around that.
It's hard to think about. I mean, you picked the sort of random number that you just picked would be 4 ice ages. So that would be in the lifespan of that individual, they would experience ice ages kind of like we experience seasons. An example that I like to tell people to sort of help you to wrap your brain around it is just imagine that our lifespans were just a day. And it's not sad that you die after a day. That's like a good old age. That's like your grandkids who were born around noon gather at your side and you know, send you off to your forever sleep at midnight or whatever. And that's just normal. So if that was the lifespan of humans, then we would have many, many generations within a single season. And so we would have entire civilizations who only knew trees, like deciduous trees, to be these dormant, dead things that don't do anything. And we know that trees are actually just waiting for summer to wake up and begin growing again because we have long lifespans. We live for multiple seasons. We see it happen every year. But if our lifespans were that short, we would miss that fact. And we would maybe even have whole researchers would dedicate all their time and effort to be poking these weird trees that don't do anything. Like, why do you exist? How can you be alive? You don't ever grow or anything. So that's kind of how I think about the interterrestrials.
You mentioned ice ages, and I know that you've been involved in gathering core samples in the Arctic regions. Mm-hmm. These little living things that you pulled out were hanging around when Vikings were there and have outlived those Vikings.
Yeah. Vikings aren't even that old. I mean, it's possible some of them were there before humans, modern humans, even evolved.
The great Carl Sagan would invite somebody like you and me and everybody to contemplate our smallness in the cosmos, looking past the moon, past Pluto, out past the Milky Way, to the farthest reaches. And you've been playing with time here. You know, the humans with maybe if we had the 24-hour lifespan, and then the trees, maybe a bristlecone pine of several thousand years. And then you go cosmological. How do you even sleep at night, Karen, thinking about these things?
I sleep very well. I love that there's mystery in the world. It makes me happy. I think that this could definitely be a strategy for life on other planets. And I think that, well, you know, I guess this is a worry, is that if life on other planets or other planetary bodies is all this slow, if they're just permanently slow, then they are going to be hard to detect. You know, we could be standing at the surface of an extraterrestrial body. I don't want to say planet because Europa is like high on the list of good possibilities to find life, and that's a moon. But, you know, we could be standing at the surface staring at something that's alive and not know that it's alive because it's not moving and it doesn't look like it's doing anything. But actually it is, just really, really, really slowly.
None of this is science fiction, so what Karen is describing here, well, she's guiding us through some revolutionary changes to our past scientific thinking about the capability of these minuscule living organisms to persist. And what's possible for intraterrestrials also has implications for the characteristics and abilities of extraterrestrials. Alien life, or something just like it, might be reflected right here within our own reach. Things just living so slowly as to have escaped our notice. But rather than get lost somewhere in outer space, let's keep things to places where Karen Lloyd has been. Though the microbes she studies may seem rare, it turns out that you don't have to walk into a volcano to find them. Early on in Karen's career, this happened when she was in grad school, a mentor of hers suggested that she scout out a nearby field or a venue for future research visits, a place not too hard to access, and that could serve as a reference for whatever new questions might arise in her science. She settled on using tidal zones and estuaries near where she grew up in North Carolina, places like the White Oak River. And surprisingly, some of the very same microbes she has found in remote locations like a volcano also inhabit these coastal sediments. The more I learned from her about her work, the more persuaded I became that these life forms are far from rare. But I have to say, there's considerable excitement in the whole idea of reaching the most elusive of them all, and that means descending, and not just inches or feet, from a place you call home. If you would be so kind as to help me out with this, I am imagining going down, getting a core sample. You've got all this machinery, these drills, whatever it takes to go down, 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 down. And then you bring out this column, whether it's in ice or whether it's under the ocean or whether it's in North Carolina on the coastline, you're pulling them out. And I'm imagining, yes, there's sort of a time chart there where you can go back, back, back in time as you go down the column. But I also have this urge to say, it's just gotta be that they're livelier on the top and they're deader on the bottom. Is that all wrong?
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah?
No, you got it. Yeah, you got it.
But not so dead as to be totally dead at the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. It's like grades of dead. It's like in The Princess Bride when it's like, well, he's only mostly dead. Yeah, we see that. We see that the metabolic activity is high at the surface, the number of cells are high at the surface, and it drops off quickly. And everything slows down, and depending on what food there is, it's all driven by the availability of food, right? So if the food drops off quickly, then within like a foot or so, or you know, less than a meter, you can get to very energy-starved populations.
I eat and I have a metabolism, and so do these creatures, right?
Yeah.
But help me understand, there's metabolism and then there's respiration.
Mm.
And both of those functions have inputs coming into my system inside my skin, and then I can exhale and I can excrete. But there's a difference between respiration. And the thing that's so cool that I just blew my mind is the idea that one of these little microbes might be breathing, quote, something that I can't breathe. You had quite a list there.
And rocks. At the very top they of breathe it was
rocks. Gold, even.
Gold,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I think that part of why this is a little hard to understand is that they break things down differently than we do. Because we talk about metabolizing, eating a meal, and breathing. We understand that we eat sugars, we eat fats, we eat protein, and then we breathe oxygen. And those are sort of the two ends of our equation. And then that turns into our bodies and it turns into waste. They do the same thing, but they divide it up. They basically can separate out respiration from food in a way that our food is connected to our respiration. So it's not just the oxygen. We get electrons from our food. I know that maybe sounds a little weird, but this is what we get from our food. They are more electron heavy than oxygen is. And so we do, that's happening in our cells right now. We are pulling electrons off of sugar and putting it onto oxygen. And that powers us. That's what's happening in our mitochondria that makes us be able to do all the things that we do.
I'm going to trust you on all of this I'm trying to hang with it, but
I know,
go ahead.
It's a little weird. We don't usually talk about electrons when we go out to eat, but that's what we're doing.
Appetizer. Mm.
Chemically, that's what happens. I mean, we're all kind of like these little batteries. We don't think about that because we see our food and that's how we see it. But with these intraterrestrials and with the microbial world in general, it breaks it down and into these more essential parts. And so they can get their electrons from things that are not the same thing as their food. They can get their food from sugars or from fats or proteins, just like we can, but then they could get the electrons from something like iron or from sulfur or from nitrogen, things that don't seem like food at all, that they're just like part of the periodic table. In fact, everything in the middle of the periodic table, all the transition elements, the stuff, most of it is like super toxic, like arsenic and vanadium and selenium, stuff that like you can kill yourself with if you ingest it.
Breathing and eating, respiring and metabolizing. I can get a little lost in the distinctions here, but I think I probably have succeeded in wooing away an electron or two while nibbling on an apple or a carrot. Done that myself, and certainly you have too. The main takeaway for our purposes here is that these single-celled microbes aren't eating or breathing the way we do. They're not sipping water from a stream or picking berries from a nearby bush. They don't chew their food, and who knows if they ever talk with their mouth full. Let's just say that they make use of elements that may well be toxic to us in the wrong quantities, iron, sulfur, even gold. They use these to power themselves. They're living in places where we can't live, respiring and metabolizing things that we can't in ways that we don't. And though that may seem a little alienating to us, they're not aliens. They're all part of life on Earth. And not to forget that we all share some DNA.
my world is fuller knowing that there's such a variety of different ways for life to be in really extreme capacities, not just that like we can have things that have a new type of tail, which is also exciting. I don't want to knock like finding a new type of monkey or something like that. That's good stuff. But when we make these discoveries, we're discovering things that have a totally new way of breathing than we knew before. I mean, that's a fundamental diversity.
The summit of Mount Everest is part of Earth's crust, as is the very bottom of California's Death Valley. But if we leave exposed land behind, then we get to include the seafloor as part of the crust as well. Karen's scientific research has taken her down to the seafloor. Like her perilous adventure inside an active volcano, sinking to the bottom of the ocean had its own set of genuine risks. She has gone down in a submersible craft with a front end that looks very much like a helicopter's soap bubble canopy or windshield. This vessel can accommodate only 4 occupants, 2 of whom ride in the back in a sort of long box. And I'll let Karen tell you what they call that.
There's a big plexiglass ball in the front, and there's one pilot and one scientist who sit in the front. In the back is what we call the coffin, and you have to lay down, and you can't really sit up straight, and it's like an extra pilot and an extra scientist, and you kind of can't do as much back there, and it's really cold. And that's where I was.
Well, Karen, we're going to talk about your first time ever in this submersible. It was in the Gulf of Mexico, and right now, actually, as it happens, I'm looking at a picture of this submersible. It's called the Johnson Sea Link 2 with that bubble on front of plexiglass. It looks like it would give you a great view. Maybe not if you're back in the coffin. I don't know. But for me, it would induce a whole lot of claustrophobia in the coffin or in the bubble. And the cold, too, that you've mentioned, did those things worry you a lot?
Even though I wasn't in like the really nice place, I didn't care. Because I just wanted to go. I just wanted to go to the bottom of the ocean. I'd been studying this for forever, and however it took, I was going to get down there. And so the morning, this is how I start the book, but this is absolutely true. You know how like when you're waking up in the morning and your brain is not quite there yet, and you don't know like what end is up and what your name is yet? So before I figured out any of those things, the very first thought, like the deep lizard brain thought that came in my head was, oh, please let this boat be still. Please let this boat be still. Like before I even remembered that I was on a boat, I was like, oh, let it not be throwing me around too much in my bunk. And the reason is that when you're launching a submersible off the back of a research ship, you know, we live out there for weeks on these ships, and we launch the submersible every day off the back with people in it. And so that's a fiddly thing to do. And you can't do it if the boat is rocking and rolling.
Your first time down. The pilot went to sleep.
He did. He did. Before we even left the photic zone. It was so funny. I mean, it is. It's very relaxing. It's cold. You know, there's lots of blankets and stuff. We were lying head to foot. He's a very pleasant guy. And he just like, you know, he just said, I hope you have a lovely dive. I'm going to sleep. Wake me up if you need anything. He slept through the whole dive. But I'm sure he had a great nap. I couldn't sleep, though.
Compare this environment, this habitat, with that volcano.
In both of them, you have this feeling like nature will kill you. You know, it's like you can love nature, but nature doesn't like love you. You know, you'll die. You know, if a porthole breaches or if the seals fail in your submersible, you will die. Or if you get hooked on something in the bottom of the ocean and you just can't surface. Of course, again, we have lots and lots of safety layers so that these things don't happen. But the ocean's not going to take care of you.
What you observed in both of those places, you would never describe those places as barren.
No.
As wastelands.
No, no, absolutely not. I mean, there's life everywhere. I mean, it's natural, and something has evolved to live in this space and do something cool there.
You watch all the fishies going down in the submersible?
Yeah, the fish are great. Well, depending on your situations. I have had fish be a problem as well. But when you're falling through the ocean, you know, I kind of had, even as a like on paper oceanographer, I had a simplistic view of like, okay, there's these tiny little phytoplankton and these little zooplankton, and maybe once you get down to a certain level, it's just nothing until there's like a fish or a shark or a whale. Actually, that's not the case at all. It's more like a jello mold. It's just completely full, chock full with stuff. And I mean like invertebrates and like little jellyfish and just everywhere. And this stuff glows when you hit it, when you smack it. It's bioluminescence. And so if you turn off all the lights in the submersible, it glows as it goes past your porthole. So it's like sparkles. It's beautiful. And sometimes like these long segmented bodies, you'll see this like crescendo of sparkles like run through the body. And so you'll get this like flash of like, oh, that's a whole worm or something, like something crazy out the porthole. And then it just like continues on because you're falling past it. But it's full.
Saw a lot of unicorns down there, didn't you?
I felt kind of like I was looking at unicorns. Sparkles.
Yeah. So it sounds like you got far enough down, and you'll have to tell us just how far down you did go, but where no natural daylight was visible anymore?
Yes. In the Gulf of Mexico, I was diving at 900 meters, which is half a mile.
And you got down to the bottom of it?
Yeah.
And that was the point, to get to the bottom, to take samples down there.
Yeah, because we're taking, you know, we're not working, for that project, we weren't working in the water at all. So we want to get to the seafloor because that's the point. But, you know, you lose the light in the upper 100 meters or so. So for most of that, you know, we were way, way, way past the reach of any light at all.
The importance of this research trip, Karen's first to the seafloor, the ultimate value of all of this to science, well, that would unfold later in the lab, where samples of microbes underwent DNA sequencing. Don't forget now that this was nearly two decades ago.
That was 2006 that I did that dive. And when we brought the samples back and I had processed them and spent a long time in lab, and I, you know, I had my sequences, my DNA sequences at my computer, I was trying to figure out what they were. And I was choosing from these known things, you know, the things that grow in a lab bench, the things that we know about normal microbiology. And I was like, these are not normal microbiology. I don't know what these things are, but I thought I was a bad scientist. I was like, okay, these are supposed to be bacteria. Let me figure out what they are. And I was like, I don't know, I'm screwing it up. And, you know, I was talking to other researchers and they're like, you're not screwing it up. We're getting the same thing. This is new stuff.
Nothing excites trained researchers quite like finding new stuff. From Japan and Korea to South Africa and Germany, scientists were independently sequencing and corroborating what Karen Lloyd was also finding through her work in her lab. Genetic material that had never been described before, and on the face of things looked like a messy bunch of degraded genetic residue, detritus, from other life forms. And if the samples had been contaminated with degraded bits of known DNA, then as Karen feared, maybe she had been screwing it up. But that wasn't the case. The corroboration from around the world led to a rewriting of the Tree of Life to accommodate the existence of two new phyla, which is to say two wholly new and unexpected classes of living things. There's a footnote in her book that identifies these phyla. They're called Thermoplasmatota, Thermoplasmatata, and Lokiarcheota, Larki, Loki, Loki, Lokiarcheota, well, new branches on the Tree of Life. All of this could get a little too specialized for most of us, so let's just talk briefly about crabs, shall we? One of the most enjoyable parts of my getting to visit with Karen Lloyd is that she's just so approachable a person. She's just like the rest of us who may not be life scientists at all, but who find life utterly amazing and wondrous. Here's how she describes what happened on that very first dive in the submersible in the Gulf of Mexico when they landed on the ocean floor.
It was like meeting a famous person. You know, it's kind of like if you have some movie star that you just love and you love their movies and then you see them in person, you might be a little speechless. You know, I felt that way about seeing the seafloor for the first time. It's like, okay, this is it. It's right here. This is the deep sea. I'm half a mile down. And it didn't look like much. I was like, okay, this is pretty bare. But then, you know, I sat for a little while longer and I saw there were a sea anemone. There were crabs. There was a crab that wanted to fight us. It was really, really cute. It was like, this poor thing, you know, being visited by a submersible is not something that happens often for sea life. And so you can imagine this crab spent its entire life never having seen anything from humans at all. And then suddenly this like alien ship lands right in front of it. And so it just stood there with its claws open and like ready to fight us.
You do realize, Karen, that you are a rare individual to have had that experience. Very, very few of us would ever do that. And does that mean anything to you that you got to?
Yeah, it feels, I feel a responsibility. I really do. I mean, it's a part of the world that, you know, probably that exact part of the seafloor, no human will ever see it again. You know, the chances of somebody falling exactly where we fell again is very, very low. And so it's a little bit like if you are an astronaut and going to a new place, you would feel responsible. You would want to tell everybody everything you can about it. And so again, that was definitely motivating me to write and to share this stuff with people. But it's, you know, felt like looking at the truth, and I want people to know the truth of what's really on our Earth and in our Earth.
Karen Lloyd is absolutely insistent that some of the most extraordinary life forms on Earth exist not in the deserts, rivers, or mountains, but in the darkness underneath our feet, waiting patiently in stone and sediment. For me too, even as a non-scientist, there's more than just a little wonder in the fact that whenever I look at a muddy riverbank, an ocean, or a pile of rock, there are innumerable living, single-celled microbes tucked away right there, able to metabolize without a mouth, to respire without gills or lungs. Karen writes, once we begin to peer downward past our feet into the deep dark recesses of Earth's crust and oceans, a new world emerges. This world has been sitting here underneath us the whole time, and we've missed it, as though we've been tricked by a magician's sleight of hand. Karen Lloyd's book is titled Intraterrestrials, Discovering the Strangest Life on Earth. This episode was produced by Jess Scoville with assistance from Mamie Teeples and Lily Jensen. Sound design by James Call. I'm Marcus Smith. The Constant Wonder podcast is a production of BYU Radio. I want to take a moment and recommend another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, The Lisa Show. With life's great onslaught, everything that can overwhelm us and add stress to our life, Lisa Valentine Clark, her guests, and Council of Moms provide a practical, positive outlook on our ongoing daily challenges. They tackle problems head-on with wisdom and experience. You'll hear suggestions for better handling interpersonal relationships, useful ideas related to health, technology, body image, family, and a host of other important issues. It's called The Lisa Show, and of course, it's available wherever you get your podcasts.